the other side fundamentally broke that compact of our elections and our democracy by saying, if we lose, it doesn't count, and then laying the political and legal and professional groundwork to make that an issue in 2024, both online and offline, is very scary to me. And I think it should be scary to a lot of Americans, regardless of party.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today is Adam Connor, who's put together a career in the intersection of technology and politics. He's currently the Vice President for Technology Policy at the Center for American Progress, where he works on building a progressive technology policy platform and agenda. Adam was the first Washington employee for Slack Technologies, the fast-growing workplace communication startup. And prior to that, Connor was Vice President of Brigade at Civic Engagement Platform. And before that, he founded Facebook's Washington office and worked for 7 years on their Facebook privacy and public policy team. He also has congressional and campaign experience on the Democratic side. We had a lot to talk about, including the role of Facebook and other social media platforms in our politics. Adam is well worth your listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Adam Connor, now of CAP.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Adam, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Adam Connor. I am the Vice President for Technology Policy at the Center for American Progress, a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C., where I lead the technology policy team. I'm also the same title and position at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, which is our C4 sister organization. I have been there about 2 years. I'm the inaugural founder of the technology policy team at CAP, which is the first time they've had a technology policy team, where We have actually a fairly broad and fascinating mandate. So we are a cross-cutting issue, as we like to say. We have a portfolio of policy issues we work on, technology regulation, antitrust, content moderation, disinformation and misinformation. But we also, because CAP has 18 other or 19 other policy teams, work across a lot of policy teams because technology is such a part of so many different things now. So we work closely with the National Security team on cybersecurity and competition abroad. We work closely with our economic team to think about antitrust legislation. We work closely with our rights and justice team on various aspects of civil rights and other things. So I think it's a really privileged position we're able to be in, and you know, kind of really enjoy the work. And then prior to that, I spent the last 15 years or so working for Silicon Valley companies in Washington, D.C., at the intersection of technology, policy, and politics. So I was the first Washington, D.C. employee of Facebook in 2007, when it was still a relatively young company. And I was there for 7 years, where I built out the policy and the political engagement team and oversaw a bunch of different civic and election related work in 2008, 2010, 2012. I then went to a civic tech startup called Brigade, which was funded by Sean Parker, where I did and learned a lot of different things about the civic tech and the startup world. And then I spent 2 years at Slack Technologies, thinking a lot about enterprise software, cybersecurity, and the changing nature of work and technology. In between all of those things, I've kind of been a long-term online organizer and progressive. So I was an original member of the Netroots was a contributor to a blog called Mighty D, which is often called the kind of blog father. It kind of spawned Daily Coast and other entities with different people, including Matt Stoller and Jerome Armstrong. And then worked on political campaigns for a bit and kind of got my start in online organizing, which led me eventually to Facebook. I've continued to work in progressive politics since then. So I am what's called a late helper, which is a person who usually takes a couple weeks off near an election and deploys back to the field to run a field office. So I've done that for the last several cycles in various swing states and also remain involved in politics in a lot of different ways. After I left Slack, it was after the 2016 election. There was a lot going on in the world, as you can imagine. And I think for somebody that had played a big role in thinking about politics on the internet, it was also something that required, I think, some introspection and self-examination. I did a great fellowship at Harvard where I spent a lot of time thinking about the future of technology and technology regulation, and then came to CAP. So long-winded, but hopefully that's helpful.
It's not long-winded when you've done a lot. It is really quite an amazing career, which I've only seen a tiny bit from afar. Since I don't know you well, can you acquaint me with your early path? Like, how did you first get into politics? Did you have a family that was political? Did you get into it in college? What was the spark there?
You know, it's a great question. You know, I don't have a super political family. I grew up in New Mexico, primarily, a little town called Los Alamos. One of the things that happens when you grow up in a small town is sometimes you think about bigger places, and particularly when you grow up in the mountains far away from things. I had been interested, I think, vaguely in politics. I kind of was one of the generation that thought The West Wing was a cool TV show and thought the idea of being in the center of things was really exciting. And I took a trip to Washington, D.C. when I was in high school and really kind of fell in love with the place. And I took a tour of the George Washington University and kind of just said, I think I want to go here and be at the center of it all, which was their kind of slogan at the time. And looking back, I didn't really understand politics. I really didn't understand a lot of things, but I understood things happened geographically in this kind of field in Washington, D.C., and that it made sense to be there. And so I went to GW and it really worked out well. I think it really shaped who I was as a person and gave me a ton of opportunities.
George Washington University. I think it attracts a lot of people that think they might be political. And why wouldn't it, being right in the middle of the nation's capital, right?
Yeah. I think looking back, that can be a pro and a con for the kind of person who seeks excitement. I think there's a lot of people for whom the values and the excitement and the work is a really strong motivator. And there are some people who just like to be near something cool and don't always do it for the right reasons. I think I was lucky enough to really, you know, fall in with a lot of people while I was there who, you know, remain, you know, both, I think, deeply enmeshed in politics. And so one of the weird things about GW is that you see a lot of your classmates, if you work in this world, you know, pretty regularly and see their careers blossom as well. You know, I think a couple of things happened while I was at GW, you know, one of which is the advantage of its location. I was able to do a lot of internships. And, you know, obviously internships are a privilege. And I think we need to have a stronger discussion about how we value them, how unpaid labor at that time, although that's shifting more, you know, really opens opportunities. But I was able to work as a speechwriter for a Democratic operative, which got me onto the Kerry campaign, which meant I could take a semester off and work the 2004 election, which was very obviously like a seminal moment in my life. And I kind of went back to school and went abroad to the UK. And a guy from the Kerry campaign called me and said, well, you're here in the UK and we've got an election, so we might as well also work on the Labour Party election in 2005. And that led me to some of the new progressive renaissance that happened after the Bush re-election. I helped co-found an organization called the Roosevelt Institute, which is now the Roosevelt Institution, which later merged with the Roosevelt Institute, which is a progressive economic think tank that I now sit on the board of, and then led me to campaigns and the draft Obama movement and a bunch of other things. So, you know, the location really gave me an up on my career pretty early, while also still letting me be a college student. And, you know, I think I'm grateful. And I'll say that everybody should have an opportunity to discover their passions. GW did that for me. And I actually now just got elected to the Board of Trustees. So now I have the privilege to kind of like also help shape the university for the future, which is a exciting and a daunting thing simultaneously.
Yeah, that's really a big full circle fairly early in your life, I think. Quite an honor. Trace things forward from where you kind of left off a little bit.
after I graduated from college, or while I was actually still in college, I started working for then Virginia, former Virginia Governor Mark Warner, while he was trying to understand what he was going to do with his future. And there was a period of time where he was thinking about running for president. And so in 2006, after I graduated from college, I joined his political action committee, traveled with him to New Hampshire, traveled with him to South Carolina. You can imagine the kind of reasons somebody in 2006 would be doing that kind of trip. And I became part of their online organizing team. And I had the kind of distinction to think about how to use new technologies. So because I had been in college, Facebook had come out then and I had access to it when others didn't. And so I spent a lot of time really thinking about how to use social networking for online organizing. I hold the distinction now, whether positive or negative, for buying the first political advertisements ever run on Facebook by a political candidate.
And that was for his presidential?
Technically, it was what's called a federal leadership pact, because in 2006.
Forward Together.
Exactly. Yeah.
I remember talking to the Warner campaign from where I was in political software. They were ahead of the game in terms of thinking about technology and thinking about a campaign. They were much more formidable in that area than a lot of the other incipient contenders.
100%. And, you know, one of the lucky breaks in my career was to be a part of a team that Jerome Armstrong had put together, who had founded MightyD. Trey Brundrett and Pablo Martinez were software developers at a time when most campaigns didn't have that. Trey would later go on to help co-found Vox Media. Nancy Scola, who's now a really celebrated technology writer, sat next to me. So it was really a kind of fascinating environment that, you know, unfortunately, didn't result in a presidential campaign. Now, I think to then Governor, now Senator Warner's great credit, to look at the 2008 field in 2006 and see Barack Obama, to see Hillary Clinton getting in, to see John Edwards, who had been the vice presidential nominee 4 years before, and understand that as good as he was, the oxygen level might be difficult, was really, I think, as hard as it was to be on a campaign that didn't get started, it was, you know, almost certainly a call with the right foresight. And then obviously, he was then elected to the Senate in 2008.
What was your path to Facebook?
So as I mentioned, when I was at the Warner PAC, we were doing a ton of really interesting things in online organizing. And around that time is when Facebook had really started to have some of its first really interesting moments, one of which was the launch of Newsfeed, which happened in 2006. I mentioned I had been blogging at the time, and so I wrote a piece for then tech president, which Mika Sifri was running, about how the viral nature of the newsfeed was really kind of just this new force. And in particular, people who were around then will remember that the newsfeed was very controversial. It garnered a lot of protest groups, but the reason the protest groups grew exponentially was because the newsfeed was feeding it. So people would join a We Hate the Newsfeed group, it would be fed into newsfeed, it would get visibility, and then that cycle would grow. And I kind of wrote a piece that talked about the online organizing potential of that for elections and how it was going to change politics. And through some of that work, met some folks at Facebook who were there. I mentioned we bought the first Facebook ads in swing states and had a conversation with them. And then, you know, after the campaign ended, we stayed in touch. I went to Congress. I worked for Louise Slaughter on the House Rules Committee, which is a really obscure part of the House that's also the most powerful. So I like to call it my unexpected graduate school and floor procedure, because it's the way that the House of the difference between the House of Representatives and the United States Senate at its core is that the U.S. House of Representatives, when it comes to how things are considered, has something called the Rules Committee. And the Rules Committee sets what bills come to the floor, how long there will be debate for, what will be considered and what won't, and how it will. And the Senate, it operates in a much different procedure, often by unanimous consent. Single senators can object, and it's much more distributed in terms of its power, but the House is really run by that. And so while I was there, I was really, again, thinking about from the official side. And if you've never worked on the official side of Congress or in government, it's like a really interesting and different experience with limitations on how we use taxpayer funding, how you can, you know, kind of do certain things under the law as an elected official versus as a candidate. I was, again, thinking about Facebook technology, how we should use it. And so as part of that, I had kept in touch with people at Facebook, and the first Facebook general counsel, Chris Kelly, kind of called me up in 2007 and said, we're thinking about hiring someone to help in Washington to both talk to people who want to use Facebook to help us handle policy stuff. I don't want to keep flying out there every week. And so I said, you know, I'd really like to apply for that job. I would kind of be a dream. And he said, oh, I meant to just give it to you. You just got to tell me when you can start.
It's a good way to find a job.
Yeah. And it was, you know, truly, I think Facebook at the time was only a few years old. We were, I think, sub 400 million users when I joined. We had just opened up to high schools and then to everyone. It was a true startup. And, you know, it was the beginning of my adventures in startup and Silicon Valley land, which is a really interesting place for better or worse.
I recently interviewed kind of your successor in that role there, Katie Harbath. And I assume you hired her or brought her in. Even though she starts substantially after you, it's remarkable to think about how much changed, how sort of naive and civically oriented some of the mindset seems to have been, which must have been even more so back when you started. But like, how did you see Facebook and politics in those days and over the course of your tenure there?
That's a great question. And I will say, yes, I hired Katie. I think it was very clear from anybody who was watching Katie's career that she was a generational talent in online organizing and thinking about the future of technology. And we were really lucky to get her, not just because we wanted to make sure that when we were talking to elected officials on both sides of the aisle, they could talk to somebody they could trust and relate to, but also because separate from the kind of party registration aspect, she just is somebody who has thought about the broader aspects of these things, even before she came to Facebook, while she was there. And certainly, I think, as you heard in her interview, you know, as she processes, you know, being outside of Facebook. When I joined Facebook, there were a couple of ways I would describe it. One of which is that it was still so early on that few people believed in its potential. So it was just a lot of trying to convince people that this was going to be a thing. And I used to describe it as this, which is I was like the first guy selling fire or the wheel. I had a pretty strong sense that it was going to succeed. And once you tried it the first time, you wouldn't go back. But if you've never experienced fire in the cave or you've never rolled something, you know, on a cart with a wheel, it's going to seem weird and you're going to be skeptical and you're going to maybe not want to do it. And so a lot of the initial effort was really on how do we get people to think about it, to try it in a way that we think can succeed, which often meant authenticity, not just putting out a press release or things like that when people use the service, thinking about networks there. Ironically, in many ways, politicians were well equipped to understand social networks. You know, you don't get elected without having a sense of people in the world, about how networks overlap and how you can take advantage of them and the advantage of contacting them. So there were some aspects there that I think politicians got before brands or other things did. But then there were always complications. So I think from a political perspective, there is that. I think from a kind of how we look back on the world then and how I look at it today, post-2016, post-Brexit, post-Cambridge Analytica, post-Donald Trump, you know, is that I was younger. And I think a lot of us in that space had a real optimism that technology would not just be a leveler, but would be kind of default naturally to be beneficial, which, you know, I think in retrospect is not how historical new technology trends have turned out. But the way in which I thought about it was maybe it was 80-20, 80% good, 20% bad, and that kind of made up for it. You know, I think certainly today, I would say I no longer have that mostly positive orientation. You know, I think there's a strong argument to say we're at a 50-50 or 40-60, depending on which side you're a pessimist or an optimist on. And so there are a lot of negatives to technology and harms that we spend a lot of time in my day job working to try and understand how we can combat. But I think at the time, there was a lot of optimism and we saw things in a positive way, like the Obama campaign, like the Arab Spring.
I can't help but ask you about Trump and Facebook. You referenced it, and other platforms like Twitter and so on. How do you see his use of that to set himself apart, to communicate information that is frequently not true, and the intersection of what he does with that world of social networking?
Donald Trump is a bad person and a fascinating case study. And I would say this in a couple of ways. I spent the early part of my career trying to convince elected officials and political candidates that this was a tool that was worth using and could help win them elections. And it was not always an argument that people bought. I often tell people that if you had a time machine and you went back to 2010 or 2012 when I was working at Facebook and you said, hey, in a couple of years, the president of the United States is going to multiple times a day from his own personal phone, from the White House, tweet himself to the American public, and we will all know it's him, and it will be real. I would say, wow, that sounds amazing. And they'd say, well, it's not. And I'd say, I have trouble conceptualizing how that could be bad. Because I think at the time, the idea would be that a leader using new technologies to communicate with us was probably going to be great and really interesting. And obviously, we saw two aspects of Donald Trump online. There is Donald Trump himself, or through Scarvino or other intermediaries, tweeting, and I would argue also using Facebook. And I did some really interesting research about how his tweets get reposted to Facebook and get an even broader audience. And then there is how his campaign and the other apparatus took advantage of that environment. And they are intricately linked, but they're kind of two different things at the same time. And so they're both important, and we can talk about them a little bit. But, you know, in my mind, Donald Trump is those two things. And the third thing is this kind of culmination of positive and negative, right? An outsider being able to use new technologies, except that populism, except that misinformation, except that fear and hatred can be used as a primary motivating tool, which were things that I think I hadn't anticipated. And so when I left Facebook in 2014, you know, before the 2016 election, certainly would not have been my prediction. I don't know how things might have changed if I'd stayed, but I do think that some people, and we should listen to the people who were right, and I was not necessarily among them, called very early on that this was not something to be taken lightly, that Donald Trump was a really unique threat who could take the kind of changed political environment and manipulation of a media and online environment to success. I think a lot about what voices were right then and how we can make sure we listen to those kind of voices again in the future.
Did you enjoy working there? Was it a good place to work?
Absolutely. I was young. I was a couple years out of college, and it was easily the most, maybe the second most exciting thing I've ever done. I've worked on presidential campaigns, and there is honestly nothing like a presidential campaign in the sense that your outcome, win or lose, is like pretty titanic. And also, like prior to the 2020 election, pretty clear that we had winners and losers and a system that adjudicated that. Presidential campaigns are so exhilarating because they end and you know when they're going to end. Facebook was, you know, often described as a rocket ship at a moment in time, and when I caught it, and the work was new and it was fascinating. And a lot of the things, for better or worse, that we rely on in the world today in the online space, we were kind of having to figure out as we went along, particularly when it came to politics, when it came to government, when it came to civic engagement. And so it was really exhilarating for somebody who cares deeply about politics, who has a design mind and thinks a lot about how products should be built, but also thinks about, you know, kind of broader implications for society. Facebook's a complicated place, and it changes even while I was there and after I left. And in many ways, it's like your alma mater, you know, for me, right? It's, for better or worse, the institution I will always be associated with and always have a lot of memories of. And, you know, I think that it is a shame when we talk about Facebook today and the antitrust debates and other things that the kind of bigness of these companies and the monopoly and lack of competition means there's not a lot of opportunities for people like me to try and ride a new technology and really understand what's coming next. And I think that makes me as sad as any of the many kind of policy and other democratic aspects that we can talk about as well.
I mean, Facebook, as much or more than any other company, is controlled by the guy who started it. Did you have much of a relationship with him? Do you have a sense of his values and like his decision-making that you care to share?
Oh, I'll say two things. You know, one, just to, for some context for listeners, Mark Zuckerberg follows a trend that is very popular and was very popular in Silicon Valley around the time Facebook started, and in particular because Sean Parker had been president of Facebook and had lost control of one of his previous companies, where it's called dual class shares. And essentially, founders have a kind of controlling share that can never be overridden, that his votes are worth 2 or 5 or 10 times more than you as a public stockholder if your company is public, or even as a private stockholder if it's not. You see it at other institutions like Google. But that's kind of the context for those who are wondering, you know, about why Mark Zuckerberg has such a iron grip on Facebook, even though it is a public company, you know, that you can buy stock on the stock market. So that's, I think, just helpful context there. You know, I knew Zuck and I didn't spend a lot of time with him, but it was a small company and we kind of engaged. One of the things I think most people at Facebook would be candid about, and I think has never been hidden, is that, you know, until 2016, really, a lot of what we did in the political side or the civic side happened as not a top priority. And so it was just a thing that those guys were doing over there in Washington or the civic people were doing over there. And it was, you know, nice to be able to put out the press release in November saying we got people to vote, but was just kind of a thing that existed and they didn't think about a lot. And I think there were a lot of negatives to that. Obviously, some of the policies that would later, you know, have to be created or never had been wrestled with were not noticed until they were too big to ignore. But it also gave us opportunities outside of the spotlight to really, you know, kind of experiment with and try and do our best. So, you know, I think it was not something I think that Zuck thought a lot about, except in the kind of broader framework of connectivity is good, more connectivity is good. The social graph should represent your real world interests and your real world things that take up your time. For some people, politics is that. For many people in a democracy, it represents a participatory opportunity that is nearly universal and that is good to also have represented in a real world representation of a social graph.
Now it's been really made clear to us some of the downside of some of these platforms, Facebook very much included. Do you have a strong theory about what the country should do to fix it, or fix it as much as it can be fixed?
You know, it's really interesting. And I think one of the reasons I'm so happy to be at CAP is because I can think about this challenge in a couple of different ways. And it is really a challenge. A lot of this can be traced back to the fact that the technology sector is relatively unregulated, which has brought us obviously to great economic heights in that sector. They are the kind of largest parts of the Fortune 100 and really drive a lot of the stock market. And so you see that. But the flip side has been this increase in concentration and this increase in harms that is just a trade-off that we have been making that is, I think, unsustainable. And I think there's a couple of things as I think about it in my day-to-day job, one of which is that the kind of big conversations we're having have to continue towards solutions. And so we've heard a lot about the work that antitrust could do or new competition policies to maybe prevent large companies or large platforms or what we call dominant or gatekeeper platforms from benefiting themselves, from crushing their competition and things like that. And those are really critical. We've also heard a lot about the need for privacy bills. The U.S. remains one of the few countries in the world that doesn't have a comprehensive federal privacy law. And we've seen a lot of abuses come from that. But I think even if those things were to be enacted, you know, there are still a lot of pieces that would be problematic in the online sector that need increasing kind of attention to address those harms. And so I think regulation starts to look like something that should be thought of and shaped there. And so it's what I spend a lot of time at CAP trying to think about the future of technology regulation on broad issues. So this is economic, this is civil rights, and this is other harms. Now, I will say there are two additional challenges, one of which is that politics, elections, and political speech really represent the hardest kind of manifestation of these problems that you can have, both for the First Amendment in this country, although I think if you look at countries that don't have the First Amendment, they also have significant misinformation and disinformation problems. They also have a rise in authoritarianism, and that is a big challenge. That is a thing that even if we solve some of these other pieces, will remain. I think there's a strong argument to say that even if we are not going down the path of maybe regulating mis and disinformation, which can have a really huge and complicated impact, addressing some of the antitrust and privacy and regulatory challenges would make a better system overall, which might have less abuse and less fear there. I will also just say, as somebody who thinks a lot about democracy, so at CAP, we're actually unique. We sit within our democracy wing. So we sit with our people who think about voting rights and elections and institutional structures. You know, we've really seen how these technologies have both strengthened and increasingly weakened that. And I think, you know, the clearest articulation of this is the delegitimization of the election and the big lie that has been spreading. We wrote a report in October of 2020 because we were so worried about election delegitimization, kind of screaming that they were going to try and say the election was rigged no matter what happened and that we might see violence, say, at certification of election on January 6th. One of the things that I think people don't appreciate is that a lot of the things that are happening now in state legislatures and in the media landscape is to kind of legitimize this for the next time. And so I think there's a big fear there. And I think that leads to another question of, you know, should we have a very bad 2024 where Donald Trump either legitimately or illegitimately wins the election? What kind of tools will we need, you know, to keep this democracy alive? And some of those might be tools you'd want to use to prevent mis- and disinformation, you know, prior to a Trump election, but might really be missed when we have another Trump presidency. So there's just a lot of interlocking factors, and I'm happy to dig into them. But, you know, I think about all of those things simultaneously, and it is, it's not always a cause for optimism.
No, and we're not often good at regulating at the pace of technology.
No, although, you know, I think this is what I've been working on and you know, will be hopefully coming out in a few weeks, how to think about regulate at the pace of technology. So we've been thinking about a lot of new regulatory frameworks that might be able to handle that. I think, you know, the additional things I mentioned, things like the antitrust bills that are passed through the House now, which basically what's called just prohibits certain things and structurally separates other things or breaks up other things, you know, allows for those things to just maybe be less abusive from the start. And so, or privacy law that applied to everyone. So we don't necessarily regulate at the speed of technology. I think we need a regulatory system that can adjust to that, but it's not impossible. And I spend a lot of time trying to think about how we can make that better.
That sounds like a worthy pursuit. I hope you meet with some success. Jumping out and going over to Brigade, which is not unrelated to Facebook in multiple ways. Tell me about Brigade. My sense of it from quite afar was it was one of many efforts like that, almost all of which died starting in about 2000. But this one was maybe the best funded, most serious. What was it and why didn't it make it?
Sure. You know, Brigade, I think, fell in a long line of what you mentioned of this kind of civic tech sphere. And I'd say for those who kind of only intermittently pay attention, civic tech tends to kind of actually be a blanket term that's used for technology in the service of the public sector or elections or civic engagement, when in reality, those are kind of three very different buckets, right? The work that the U.S. Digital Service does out of the White House to make government technology better and fix healthcare.gov is different than the kind of work that we do to try and get people more civically engaged, is different than the tools we use to drive out people in elections from a partisan point of view. And so when we talk about civic tech in this case, you know, this was also in 2014 at the height of the app craze, right? Like everything could be fixed with a mobile app. You know, you still see some of these strains of thinking today. Brigade was really, I think, an attempt to encompass a lot of those pieces from somebody who thought very passionately about it. So Sean Parker thought it was important to fund technology that could try and stand on its own and have a runway because of the serious challenges in getting people involved in civic and growing successful applications and companies. And so it was an attempt to try and figure out, can we make civic engagement a part of people's daily lives? I won't quite call it a tender for politics, but it was a, you know, a way of saying, here are some lightweight opinions and you can swipe left or right and you can, you know, kind of understand maybe ideologically where you stand based on that or meet other people ideologically who are in the same kind of piece. And then we tried to layer on voting, right? So your elections are coming up. We had local elections when I was there in San Francisco and a couple of other places. And so, you know, could we put ballot cards together based on your policy preferences to say, you know, it looks like you care about the environment a lot. Here's your what your ballot looks like, you know, using the Google Civic API. Here are the environmental orgs in San Francisco that have made their endorsements of these environmental candidates. So you should vote for these three people if you care for the environment. And we, you know, kind of tried to mash all those things up and try and create a kind of what was the prevalent idea of the social networking at the time, which is like, how do you get daily active users or regular engagement? And I think, you know, the challenge of civic tech and the challenge of elections is that it isn't a space that always feels rewarded for daily engagement. So, you know, you might call your senator but you don't want to do it every day, particularly if it doesn't make a difference. Or, you know, elections are really great motivating things, but they only come around every couple months or years, depending on where you live. And so it was a really big challenge that was well-funded. We had a great engineering and another team, but it was kind of trying to solve everything. And sometimes that can be difficult to solve anything. One of the ironies of Brigade was, you know, and I think this is a good microcosm of the world as we saw it, was a lot of the data they got in the lead up to the 2020 election really showed Donald Trump doing well among kind of app audiences. And they like, I had left the company by then, but they thought it was wrong. They just thought maybe the tools were wrong or the audience was wrong. And it turned out to have actually been a pretty interesting bellwether when they went back and looked at it post-election on some of the things that they saw rising and falling. But, you know, the civic tech space, I think, has always suffered from two things, what I mentioned before, which is the idea that things that need to be successful need daily engagement. And this is a very difficult space to keep people engaged daily, even during the Trump era, where progressives were motivated, I think, more than any other time in my life to take daily action, because the feedback loop isn't necessarily instantaneous. And the other is, you know, is there a business model there, not even profitable, but like is sustainable? And I think one of the things we've seen from a lot of these efforts is the sustainability is really difficult in both the consumer side, which Brigade really aimed for, but even the enterprise side or the you know the kind of business side. And so I think that's a really fascinating piece to me to see either investments made in companies that are just there to exist, and you saw some of that in 2020 to get us through, or to say maybe they need the kind of scale of large companies, and you see, I won't call them monopolies, but you see increasing concentration in this on the political tech side or other sides as well, that I think is a really interesting trend.
People come to me frequently. I have an idea for a social network for politics. What advice would you give someone like that who is launching something in that area?
I have had this conversation dozens of times in my life. I'm sure you have too. I have two approaches. I will often tell them in the first conversation, do not build an app. And they will say, but I want to build an app. And I will say, do not build an app. I also have a friend who has a different approach where he says, pay me a bunch of money for consulting. And they pay him money. And he just says, do not build a fucking app. Because...
What friend is that?
You know, I he will remain nameless, but would be a wonderful guest. In fact, he might have already been a guest. But I will say, you know, there is just this endemic lock-in either needing to create something new or need to create apps. So, you know, the app is often thought of as the panacea for the consumer side. How do we get people to have more information? How do we get them to participate more? Maybe they just don't have information access. There's always the, we need to build a new data infrastructure so that we can compete on the campaign side, which, you know, I know plenty of your guests have talked about. There are places where there are real needs for real investments. I think, you know, back in 2020, for instance, when I was, you know, talking to people about the need to invest in understanding mis- and disinformation and different things, you know, there are places there, but, you know, the data wars, the voter file wars, these things are not, they're not as broken and as easily solved as I think many in Silicon Valley or technologists would like to assume. And as someone who goes into the field once every couple of years and runs a field office and logs back into the same van account and still knows where all the buttons are, like, you know, it is, you know, it isn't always an app that is the issue there.
There certainly is a cycle of people who don't know politics very well thinking they can do better because things are far from perfect. And the more patient ones can do better than the ones that think that they can throw a little bit of money in and a program at it and it'll change the world.
People ask me a lot about, so I went to Pennsylvania in 2020 for the last month or so. I took a leave from CAP and I was running a field office in Lancaster, Pennsylvania during COVID, which is, you know, kind of a surreal experience. The weird thing about field is like, it's maybe the only specialty in the world where you can just like not do it for a couple years and show back up and then do it again and like be pretty fine at it. People ask me like, what was the thing you noticed most about, you know, 2020? I say, look, it was three things on the ground. One, it's just wild to have to do everything outside and social distanced and like, but that was what it was and it wasn't the end of the world. Two, you know, obviously, you know, we just had a level of fear from both Trump and COVID that we didn't use. And three, you know, I have been living in a world since 2008 when the Obama people just decided it was easier to print walk lists, that we would always print walk lists. And everyone has just said, please God, let's just get on the minivan. Like COVID made us go on the minivan for public health reasons. And like, hopefully that's paper's not coming back anytime soon, you know, because it was just the only way we were going to do it, and it was better. It's a long way of saying it's just, you know, you see the fundamentals, we don't get well, but we want to do the shiny thing. So I have been going into the field for however many years now, and nobody pays attention to volunteer onboarding. Nobody has, you know, paid attention to the spreadsheet. Nobody has paid attention to the tools that organizers need. The only thing that's been incrementally improved is making the report more back up the ladder so they can get their metrics for the, you know, the hours. And so, you know, there's a huge missed opportunity on making actual organizers' lives better and on the distributed organizing work that was kind of pioneered by the Bernie folks that I saw a lot of when I was at Slack. You know, these are, you know, real opportunities that I wish people would invest more in because they matter as much as another data modeling model.
Going to Slack seems like a big change. Was it?
It was, you know, and it kind of ties back to the work I do today on competition policy and antitrust. One of the things that I loved about my time at Facebook was we were a startup fighting against some giants, Google in particular, and in a competitive market, and competition does do like really interesting things, and it makes you work really hard. People who work in elections know that, you know, a competitive election is a different world than a non-competitive election. And by the time I left, you really saw a couple things happening. You know, it was a big company, and so there was less kind of innovation and dynamism. When I went to Brigade, running a startup is hard because you're kind of at the mercy of the app stores and a lot of the monopolies that are there. And when I went to Slack, my friend called me who'd been at Facebook and was at Slack and said a couple of things. He said, you know, one, I had actually emailed him and said, hey, I know you're at Slack now. Here's all the interesting things happening on the tech side for politics and government, kind of similar to what I'd seen before at Facebook. And he kind of called and said, why don't you kind of come join us? We need some help with that. But it was fascinating. So much of the energy in the consumer sector is dominated by tech giants right now that there's not a lot of dynamism. But in the enterprise software section, particularly with cloud, so even things like what we're recording this podcast on, you know, a lot of SaaS services, you know, were really being dynamic. And Slack was both at the center of that in both a really dynamic enterprise environment. It was, you know, really rocketing on word of mouth, causing a lot of problems for employers and employees demanding it and different things like that. It was interesting to go to what people call kind of a boring market, right? Enterprise businesses paying for things and see just dynamism we didn't see in the consumer market anymore. It's kind of sad that as hard as they tried to make it work independently, you know, when you are competing against monopolies like Google trying to, and Microsoft trying to, you're not monopolies, large companies trying to come in and use their leverage in other fields to take over, that they had to, you know, kind of get bought out by Salesforce to continue to be competitive. So, you know, it was a great moment to be there and to learn a lot about enterprise, about sales, about cybersecurity, about really, I think the thing I take away from it is, and you saw this in the Atlantic piece this week, like Slack is just a piece that shows how, for better or worse, our workplaces are changing and our communications methods are changing. And to have a kind of on-the-ground understanding of that is something that I think has served me really well, particularly through COVID. But as I think about where the trends in work, trends in organizing, and trends in other things are going.
When I look at your recent career at CAP, at some of the places you're on the board, I guess you were also on the Innovation Policy Committee for Biden. It's a lot of thinking and policy in this intersection that you're interested in tech and politics. What have you learned about that part of the world? What makes you want to be there? What have you seen about the people that are working there? What are you learning?
Great question. You know, I think there's two motivations for me. You know, one is the pure one, which is that technology has always been something that fascinates me and its impact on the things I'm passionate about, democracy, the world, elections, have really impacted and motivated my career. And I think that is a continuation in the work I'm able to do today to say, how do these things impact the world and how can we use the policy apparatus to maybe correct that? And the other is, you know, guilt. As somebody who helped bring politics onto Facebook and politicians, for better or worse, and the things that that spawned, what responsibility do I have and how can I use some of that knowledge to try and at least make up for where I was wrong and hopefully make it better for future generations? So, you know, those are the motivations. I think what's fascinating to me is two things. One, you know, there are a lot of people who are thinking about technology. there is this myth that it's too complicated to understand. I think one of the things that's really interesting about something like technology is just how, because it's so prevalent and touches on so many different things, how what you may be an expert in on telecom or on common carriage or on content moderation intersects with antitrust or intersects with Section 230 or intersects with all these other pieces. And it can be really easy to just say, well, because my part isn't impacted, I don't have to care about it. Or because it's not perfect on this, we can't solve it. There are really is important in technical places to have specialties, but it is even more important for people to be able to look at the whole and say, I can understand it's complicated. I can understand that we need to make trade-offs and ground them in values. How do we make those trade-offs so that they are grounded appropriately in our values? And I think that's really where the tech policy and tech regulation conversation is going. We are going to eventually regulate tech, or we are going to end up in a dystopia. And if we do regulate these technologies, how can we do it in a way that's grounded in our values? And those values could be fairness, they could be civil rights, they can be innovation. And that is a thing that I've been lucky enough to hopefully be able to look at a broad spectrum of politics and policy and be able to kind of draw lines and better understand the trade-offs and why they may be worth it.
Usually, one can't get that kind of reform through Congress unless something happens to sort of the political opportunity structure that allows a kind of a breakthrough moment where either you have giant majorities in one party or you have people across the parties both seeing the problem and willing to compromise on the solution. Like in Trump, there was a criminal justice reform bill that went through First Step Act, which you might not think, but we had some people on the right and some people on the left and the president willing to sign it. Mostly we can't get stuff through. What do you think has to change, if anything, for something substantial in these general areas that you work on to go through?
There are kind of two pieces to this. One is the scope of particularly the challenge from large tech companies and the concentration in power, economic, their control over information, their impact on elections and democracy is a thing that is certainly grown bipartisan concern. Now, those don't always end up meaning bipartisan solutions, but certainly has drawn bipartisan concern. And I think one of the things that you see from that is, are there moments of solution that can come from that? And so I think what we're seeing, as some of our friends in the anti-monopoly movement can show, is some really interesting alliances that have emerged already. In the House, for instance, there were Republican co-sponsors in the Judiciary Committee for many of the antitrust bills that went through a couple of months ago. And Democrats from, say, California, where Silicon Valley is located, with different feelings on those bills. So that is a moment that has that I would say didn't evolve out of nowhere. The anti-monopoly movement has been doing really important work, not just in the tech sector, but across concentration for a long time. And it's really found its moment in Congress with Congressman Cicilline and his work on the Judiciary Committee with the Exploring the Markets, with the kind of people that President Biden, to his credit, has really appointed to chair the FTC, and Lina Khan, to Tim Wu at the National Economic Council, really leading thinkers here. That's the today fight. You know, I am also thinking about the tomorrow fight, which is how do we come up with a framework for regulations beyond these things after we win these fights today, if we can, and how do we get them through? And the first step is idea generation, which I'm working on now, like I said. And then it'll be, how do we create those moments? I think what will happen, particularly as these companies get so big, and when there are problems, they happen at such a scale that it impacts everyone, is there will be more breakthrough moments. And I think the key is just in the ideas process to have an idea, to convince some people it was a good idea, and to kind of capitalize on it. So I don't look at this as a kind of moment that'll be done in 5 years. And I think the criminal justice reform people are a great example. First Step Act was something that they've been working for a long time. It broke through. Doesn't mean there's not more criminal justice work to be done, but it is a step that we can hopefully take.
What worries you the most right now in this intersection of tech and policy?
2024 really looms large. I joked with my colleague the other day that, you know, my hope was that I would never have to think about Donald Trump and the internet again after Twitter banned him and Facebook banned him and other things. But, you know, I think it is, you know, putting on my kind of personal hat and taking off my like professional C3 and even C4 hat, you cannot look at the trends in state legislatures, laying the framework that might have held the 2020 election kind of in place. You can't look at the people retiring who were people of character who upheld election results and are being chased out of office. You can't look at candidates running on a platform to not certify an election if Donald Trump doesn't win. You can't see all of those things interact with the big lie in the media, with the way that that is then both fed by and encouraged in an endless loop online of the big lie and election delegitimization. You can't look at all those things and not be fearful about 2024, not just on the online piece, although I certainly am, but just for our democracy as a whole. I think, you know, when I got into politics and elections, I kind of had this fundamental belief that, like, you know, we played by the rules and there was a winner and a loser. The stakes for participating in an election were you were willing to accept it if you lost. And like something fundamentally, the other side fundamentally broke that compact of our elections and our democracy by saying, if we lose, it doesn't count. And then laying the political and legal and professional groundwork to make that an issue in 2024, both online and offline, is very scary to me. And I think it should be scary to a lot of Americans, regardless of party.
It is consumingly scary to me. I'm just absolutely terrified about what's coming, which, you know, if I had to bet, is a Republican House and a very good chance for a Trump or Trump-like person in office. People I've talked to are working either on how do we win for Democrats or how do we protect the system in a nonpartisan way, just working on the democracy. But it feels like there is not a smart, centralized counterattack on this attack on the system. There's a lot of things going on, but like, given the little time we have and the high stakes, any suggestions about how do we stop this bulldozer from running over us?
I think it is a great question. And I know one of the interesting things has been, if you've worked with some people in the kind of more nonpartisan democracy field, they're just like pretty mild-mannered people who like really stridently try and be nonpartisan. And when they are screaming, we should be scared. When I scream or you scream as partisans, like it's one thing, but like, when they are doing
they're all screaming.
You know, we should be absolutely terrified. And it is scary that they becomes partisan. Obviously, we need to be pressing for as much change as possible in Congress while we have power and to protect democracy and institutions. Obviously, that is going to be a challenge that we will see how both Congress and the administration rises or falls to. I think we also have to start thinking about, you know, what it means to operate in this environment. In addition to thinking about big ideas on how to regulate the tech sector, I spent a lot of time and expect to spend more time next year really thinking about what that means tactically. So, you know, I'll give an example. You know, last year we wrote a long report about how to combat misinformation and disinformation, not at the regulatory level at Congress or an agency, but here are product changes that you could make. We took the idea that Ellen Goodman, a professor at Rutgers University, came up with of a viral circuit breaker and built it out to say, to combat coronavirus misinformation and disinformation, you know, here is a product you could build to increase friction, which is a thing that is needed in order to slow down the spread of disinformation, because it turns out the impact of a lie is in its speed. And so that if you can slow it down, it can take away some of its impact. Whereas if it's the truth, it's fine if it takes an extra hour to get out there because it is the truth and it can still have a resonant impact. And so, you know, we need to fight at that level to try and get companies to understand and implement these things. We need to fight at the political level. And it's hard. There are efforts, but I imagine they will hopefully gather for steam. I think the one thing we can say about January 2021 is, you know, the things we thought might not happen or were very rare certainly can now, and hopefully that will be taken more seriously. But, you know, I'm with you. It keeps me up at night, and it should keep us up at night.
Adam, I think we've just scratched the surface here. Is there a question that I didn't ask you that I should have?
I will just say this at the end, which is, as much as I try and focus on, or as we focused on pessimism, you know, I would just say all hope is not lost. there's still good that happens online. It is within our reach, both in this current Congress and in future Congresses, to pass reforms like antitrust bills or create new regulations like the kind I'm proposing. These aren't impossible challenges. They are hard, and they will certainly require us to be vigilant in the 2024 election. But, you know, I think the flip side is, if you are a partisan person or just a person concerned with democracy, we did beat Donald Trump once, and maybe we can beat him again, you know? So I think that that will go a long way. So I try to not be solely pessimistic while trying to be vigilant about the threats.
It's a 50-50 country, let's put it that way. And that's not the greatest odds for saving the democracy, but it's better than a lot worse. And it might get a lot worse if we don't hold on at this point.
Absolutely.
So anyway, great to talk to you.
Great.
Anything else you want to say?
No, I will just say thank you for having me, and you know, keep an eye on some of the work CAP is doing. We've got some exciting things coming out in November and December.
That was Adam Connor. Adam is at AmericanProgress.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at GreatBattlefield.com or searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.